My guest at this time is Andrew C. McCarthy. He is a former federal prosecutor best known for the prosecution of the blind sheikh Omar Abdel-Rahman and conspirators involved in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. He is the author of numerous books, the latest of which is Faithless Execution, Building the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. In the first part of our interview, which you can also find on this site, we talked about why he believes you need a political case to make for impeachment before you can make the legal case. The American people need to be on board with such a thing. Now we're going to talk about the 7 different articles of impeachment that Mr. McCarthy includes in this book that he believes the president is guilty of. And Andy, let's start with Article 1, the willful refusal to execute the laws faithfully and the usurpation of the legislative authority of Congress. This basically refers to Obamacare changing different parts of the law, deadlines and so forth, without any consultation from Congress, since it's a statutory item, changing the work requirements for welfare a number of years ago, as well as all the additions and subtractions he's made from immigration law. Why'd you put this one at the top of the list?
This sort of goes back to my old prosecutor days, Greg. I think that it's not the one that grabs everyone by the throat the way, sort of Benghazi does, and in some ways Obamacare does, although Obamacare is very much a part of this. But when I was a prosecutor, what you always want to have in the indictment is one count that's pretty much indefensible. And I think even the president's most ardent admirers would have to admit that he does not execute the laws faithfully, which is one of the most important duties that he has in the Constitution. The president is the only officer in our government who is required by the Constitution to take an oath to faithfully execute the laws and preserve the Constitution. We have a president who is very arbitrary about laws. He enforces some, he doesn't enforce others, he's selective, he rewrites them, he presumes to be able to decree federal benefits. A lot of people may like that in the hard left, because it's basically implementing their ideological program, but I think most people who look at it, if they're of good faith, have to admit that he's not following the law.
You have immigration as an issue in this one, as well as 2 others, including a separate article just for his refusal to enforce the laws on immigration. That seems to be a central theme for you throughout several of these.
Well, I think it's because it's so blatant. The president has basically taken the position at this point that he can write the immigration law himself. You know, he's tried to go the constitutional route. He's tried to go to Congress. He hasn't gotten what he's wanted. And, you know, what he ends up saying in those instances is that, if Congress won't act, I will. And constitutionally, it's not that Congress won't act. They've said no. And his response to that is to become imperious and try to impose his own program and do it in a way that not only is disregarding of the Constitution separation of powers, but also is an insult to the sovereignty of the states. I mean, basically, he's left them defenseless to deal with the many pathologies that arise out of illegal immigration. So I think it's a very serious state of affairs, and I think it's one that in the broader part of the country, you know, outside this New York-Washington corridor, people are a lot more upset about immigration enforcement than they are or they seem to be in Washington.
Article 2 is simply about usurping the constitutional authority and prerogatives of Congress, specifically with respect to events like the War Powers Act and never getting congressional authorization for the military action in Libya, as well as the recess appointments that did not happen during a recess. Article 3, dereliction of duty as commander-in-chief. That concerns rules of engagement in Afghanistan and Benghazi. Andy, when we don't still really know what the president's role was when it comes to Benghazi, and that's also an issue when it comes to Article 4 and fraud perpetrated against the American people, how hard is it to prove when we know what certain members of the administration did but don't really know what the president's direct action was?
Greg, I'm so glad you asked that question, because one of the central themes of the book, and I really tried to push back against the Obama administration and media narrative on this, is that in the system the framers gave us, it was very important to them that the president be accountable. And, you know, if you look at the Constitution carefully, you find that all of the executive power in the government is invested in one person, in one political officer, the president. It is not endowed in this vast array of executive agencies. It is singularly the president who is responsible. And what the framers said in terms of why they set things up that way is they wanted the president to be accountable if his subordinates committed wrongs. They were to be attributable to him. So, you know, it's not what Hillary Clinton does or Susan Rice does or Eric Holder or Eric Shinseki or, you know, any of the people who've become infamous over the last 5.5 years. All those acts are attributable to the president. And, you know, the way that the administration has and the media has allowed the administration to conduct itself as if President Obama sort of is a spectator to his own administration's governance, it's fascinating that they've been able to pull that off, but it really is a perversion of the system that the framers gave us.
Well, that certainly explains then Article 6 and the misdoings at the Justice Department, Fast and Furious, the civil rights voting case out of Philadelphia, and harassment of the press, among others. Last question, last article, Article 7, undermining the rights of the American people. That concerns the IRS harassment of various individuals and groups, the abortifacient mandate, and going through the UN to perhaps curtail some Second Amendment rights. How do you go about proving that one?
Well, I think it's easy enough to prove. For example, on the First Amendment rights, the administration's work from the first days of Obama's presidency in 2009 with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, that's this cabal of 57 Islamic governments, including the Palestinian Authority, they've been working on a resolution to basically curtail American free speech rights in deference to Sharia blasphemy standards. So they have essentially struck a human rights resolution that makes it unlawful to engage in expression that could incite hostility to religion. And, of course, there's only one religion that that we're talking about in this context. So, you know, proving that these things have happened, proving that, you know, there's an Obama administration mandate that attacks religious liberty, that it's not difficult to prove that these things have happened. And I don't even think it's difficult to prove that they're high crimes and misdemeanors. What the sticking point is, are they serious enough? Does the public think that this is egregious enough to remove the president from power? And at the moment, I think the answer to that is no. But I also think that, you know, people's assessment of the wages of lawlessness is changing. And you can tell that by the fact that, you know, 6 months ago, people couldn't even utter the word impeachment, and now it trips easily off the tongue of none less than Senator Lindsey Graham. So things are changing.
Speaking of Lindsey Graham, he uttered that in connection, of course, to the Bergdahl release for five hardened Taliban figures, and there's no new developments on that every day. And obviously this played out after your book went to the publisher. But what have you seen this week that would perhaps influence any of these charges?
Well, I think that what's happened in connection with the Bergdahl Taliban transfer clearly has impeachable offenses in it. I'm not impressed by the one that seems to have everybody whipped up in Washington, this 30-day notification requirement, because I think that's of dubious constitutionality. I actually think Obama has a pretty good argument on the constitutionality of that statute, because it really does try to restrict by statute his core constitutional authorities as commander-in-chief. But it seems to me to be quite beside the point when we have a commander-in-chief who is replenishing the enemy in wartime while the enemy is still on the battlefield conducting offensive jihadist operations against our guys. That's about as shocking a dereliction of duty as I can imagine. And even if the president thinks that this 30-day notification statute is unconstitutional, which I think he's got a good argument on, a year ago, Jay Carney, who's the president's agent for these purposes, stood up in front of the press and the public and said the president would honor the statute and consult with Congress before it moved any Taliban people. So, you know, lying to Congress is another thing that the framers were very concerned about, and it, too, is an impeachable offense.
Andy, we'll have to stop there. Thank you very much for your time today. We greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, sir. Andrew C. McCarthy, former federal prosecutor. The book is Faithless Execution, Building the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.